everybody. I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Welcome to the PTSD and Beyond podcast, where we give you insights into post-traumatic stress, trauma recovery, healing, and beyond. I'm Dr. Deb Lind, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind, touch your heart, and connect with your spirit, and also give you a greater understanding of yourself and others on this healing and recovery journey walked by so many of us before, wounded healers with lived experience and heroes. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into possibilities and purpose, hope, and inspiration. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. One last thing, guys, before we dive into today's episode, if you'd like an ad-free experience and like early access to new episodes and special events, I want to let you know you can join us at patreon.com. That is patreon.com/PTSD and beyond. All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. One of the things I want to mention to folks real quick is, what are your thoughts about when we bring folks on to talk with us and have amazing conversations that are from the lived experience perspective? What are your thoughts about that? I personally think it's really amazing and super cool. And then there's another level of like wowism. I don't even know if that's a word, wowism, where it's a person with lived experience and they're also a practitioner. It's like the blend of both worlds when you can have somebody to share, you know, their experiences and some of their struggles, and then also their triumphs and their breakthroughs, as well as have that foundational knowledge that helps us with saying, oh, okay, so that's where that comes from, or, oh, wow, I never thought about it that way. And it's that clinical, that educational piece that again brings that foundation of stability, which in trauma world, we're trying to look for stability because why? Stability brings safety and calm to us. And our guest today has both, blend of both worlds, is a licensed clinical social worker, as well as lived experience. And I know that you guys know him because he's got this amazing newsletter called the Mental Health Update. And today we have Jordan Brown with us today. Guys, let's give a heartfelt welcome to Jordan Brown. Jordan, welcome to PTSD and Beyond.
All right, Deb, thank you so much. And you gave me such a good introduction. I want one slight edit to it. I'm not actually a licensed social worker. I'm not licensed clinical. I was pursuing that. I am a social worker, so I have my master's. But as I was going through that years working in the mental health field and after grad school, I actually realized I probably could have more of an impact outside of the system. So I'm doing things with my, like the mental health update site and the newsletter and all that, but decided not to pursue the clinical route. So I don't have that, but I hopefully my lived experience makes up for it a little bit.
We have a lot of compatibility there too, because I decided to go the other way as well. Okay. I'm a non-licensed practitioner. And sometimes, sometimes I think that when people do meet us without having that license, then what they say and then what they think about is a barrier gets, you know, released. And we still have that educational piece to, and that knowledge to bring. And it makes us closer to have more open dialogue where someone's not thinking, oh, they're analyzing me, or sure, okay, because you know they're a clinical practitioner, then you know there are jargon type words that people may use. Absolutely. Because their world is always in the office and always in that clinic. I think that we have a value of, again, being non-licensed practitioners with the education as well as lived experience. And it brings us together as a community, I think, faster. Because again, when people can hear our stories, they're open to listen because there's a lot of that connection. And if you can share with people right now, our listeners, a little bit about your story and your journey, how you got here, because your website has a story, but I don't want to tell people the story. I want you to share the story about, you know, the shaping of your journey, because it's really empowering. And I love that you use the word empower in your story.
Oh, I love that word. I guess I'll start there. That's a good place. I love the word empower because And I'm a person who loves words in general. I'm a verbal thinker. I actually can't visualize images in my head. I'm part of the 2 to 3% of the population that has aphantasia, I guess, where I can't actually create a mental image in my mind, which I thought was normal for most of my life until a couple of years ago. But I am this writer, literary type, very cerebral. And I realize now that I've always been that way. So when I was younger, I know now that I was a very anxious child, but I didn't have the words for it. Like my parents were good parents. They're still good parents, both former teachers, but they just didn't talk about mental health. They had no terminology for it. I never learned it in school. I think I had half of one class, health class, was my mental health knowledge in middle school. And I don't even know if we did it in high school. We had the sex ed and we had all the other classes, but nothing about mental health. Mm-hmm. So I never learned anything really. And I'll do the broad story first and you can dive in wherever. I didn't really know anything when my mom in 2007, after the sudden death of her mom, my closest grandparent, she just did not deal with it well. She stopped sleeping, which I didn't know at the time, but she basically was having panic attacks. She told me she was still teaching at that time. And it got so bad where I was from 2007 to 2009. 2009 is when I graduated college from the University of Delaware. I came back getting ready to go to Peace Corps, or hopefully soon. It was kind of up in the air. And I could just tell something was seriously wrong with my mom. She was not acting herself. There were like manic periods where she was just buying things nonstop that she never used to do that. Yep. She was doing really scary things. Like I came home one day and there was a digital camera. Like, remember those old digital cameras, like the old little blocky things it was on the kitchen table and I was flipping through it. And she had taken hundreds of photos of like things like the bottom of the toilet, under the car, just like, and I thought I was in a horror film. So this kind of got worse until Thanksgiving Day. Wow. Yeah. I haven't thought about this at all. Thanksgiving Day coming up here. Thanksgiving Day 2009, I forced my mom into a hospital because she was at that point lunging at my dad, threatening to jump out of cars. She was doing things that were really scary. And so Thanksgiving Day, she got admitted for a couple of days. So that was the start of my whole mental health journey. Later, I dealt with my own mental health issues, which I can go into if you want. But 2009 Thanksgiving Day is when it all started, where I forced my mom into a hospital. She didn't want me to drive, so I, for whatever reason, you know, she was not being logical, but she said she was going to jump out of the car. So I literally was behind her, ready to grab her if she jumped out of the car while my sister drove to the hospital. And she just had, I realized now through lack of sleep, she didn't have bipolar, which is what they thought was going on. Like they gave her lithium for a couple of years. It was more of a psychotic break due to lack of sleep that came from this traumatic event, losing her mom. They talked like almost every day. And then her mom just dropped dead one day and it was just too much for her. So that was my start.
Wow.
This whole mental health journey.
You know, sometimes our journey starts with caring for someone else.
Absolutely.
And then we start having an awareness. And thank you for sharing the story about your mom. And I'm glad that she's doing better today.
She's doing better now. She's okay with it now. When that was going on from 2007, when it started, to 2009, where it was really, really horrible. It lasted probably until 2011, 2012, until her medication and just everything got back on track.
Sure.
She's better now. And I felt so guilty for forcing into her hospital because I had never done anything like that. And I didn't know anyone who dealt with anything like this. Mm-hmm. But now I know it was the right thing to do. And I'm glad that I did it.
I can relate to that personally. I've had to bring someone to a hospital 3 times, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. So I can understand.
Easy.
No, it's not easy. It's not easy. And yes, with that comes a lot of questions, because you're questioning, are you making the best decision that you can given with what you have?
Right.
And that is very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. Our mental health journey can start also when we're caring for somebody. There's something to be said about the sandwich generation, where, you know, you're caring for kids as well as parents. I cared for my dad in my early 20s at the time, which was pre Family Medical Leave Act. The Family Medical Leave Act wasn't in place yet. And so when we're caring for someone that we love, we reflect on ourselves often to think about, you know, what are challenges that we face that are similar to what our person that we love that we're caring for is facing. Was that something that started your personal mental health journey with understanding where you're at and some of the needs that are helpful for yourself?
I would say not yet at that time. I would say it was more what I was dealing with my mom is that it felt like I was taking on the caretaker role, that she was doing so not well that I felt like I had lost my mom. And I remember being in therapy and I had a big breakthrough where I started crying, where I told the therapist, I felt like my mom had died, the mom that I knew and that she may never come back. Luckily she is back and like for the most part and is doing great. And it doesn't have those same challenges, but I felt like I had to take on that, that role because even my dad really wasn't stopped. He didn't know what to do. So here I am thinking like, I think something's wrong. I think she needs to go to the hospital. And my sister and my dad were like, well, we'll just wait it out. We'll see. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Right. And,
but I didn't, my journey really started when so I told you I've always had anxiety and I realize now I've had OCD since middle school too. More the intrusive thought variety.
Yeah.
So still deal with that and take a little bit of medication still for OCD intrusive thoughts. But mine didn't start really until 2012 when I had to have sudden heart surgery. It was open heart surgery. I learned about it, I think early end of March, early April, 2012, where I had these really weird symptoms. Things were happening. Luckily my girlfriend, now wife at the time, got me to keep going back into the ER. And first they said, oh, you're fine. Nothing's wrong. Like you're fine. But I, she continued to advocate for me. I continued to trust my body. And after they did an echocardiogram, they realized that my aortic valve was leaking blood, regurgitating back to my heart, like, and that I needed to have surgery within like a month or so. So I go from being totally healthy, being an athlete my whole life to having heart surgery in June, 2012. And, you know, it's so funny. And we were, I was just talking about this with my mom the other day that the Mayo Clinic, they're so great in so many ways. And I was able to go there for my heart. I had insurance at the time, so I wouldn't have to go $150,000 in debt, but they never, and now I know this is common, but they never told me about the potential mental health impact that could happen after a major surgery. So the physical recovery was no sweat. Like I thought that would be really hard. I recovered so quickly, but it literally broke something in my brain. Symptoms that were fairly bad in high school and college just became intolerable. I the OCD, like skin checking behavior and intrusive thoughts and all of that just got so bad. And that culminated in a couple of years later going to the hospital for depression because I wasn't sleeping myself. But it started with that surgery. I see that now, that this very invasive surgery triggered so many like underlying mental health issues. And it's pretty common. So many people have reached out to me through my site that said the same thing happened to me, same thing happened to me. But Mayo Clinic never gave me any education on that.
It's really interesting. We had another guest, Jordan, Dr. Kirsten DeWitt. She's from Scotland. And spoke exactly about the communication that needs to happen with medical providers when sharing information to be more mindful of how the delivery of that information affects patients' mental health. Because she was sharing that there isn't any training on that level of communication because medical trauma is very real.
Very real. Yeah, absolutely.
There have been other guests that have come on to share their experiences with, you know, I had this, you know, medical procedure and it exasperated, you know, this reaction, which then further led to, you know, heightening other challenges that have already been there. So yes, it's true. The physical recovery is one thing. The mental health recovery is another. How did that experience lead to the empowerment and the creation of your newsletter? Because your newsletter is like amazing. And it is like, when I see you talking about it on Twitter, you know, all of the things that are involved in it. I mean, it's like its own book. It's really not a newsletter. It's like,
yeah, I guess like so own, now at this point.
Yeah, it's like a book.
I think I've put out about 400 issues now of that newsletter over 2 years, which started as a daily newsletter 2 years ago, like pretty much 2 years ago to the day. And I think in a week, it'll be 2 years. It is the culmination of a lot of things. So you see the newsletter, but it was probably bubbling up over the years where I was struggling, was in NAMI. I found NAMI to help my mom because she was still struggling so much. But what I ended up helping myself with NAMI, because I had just had the heart surgery and was having some pretty bad mental health issues. So it's funny, I got in to help my mom, but then NAMI ended up being this great thing for me. I think to explain the newsletter, I have to talk about where it started from. And it really started with my first site, which was called Nerve 10. And if there are any dorks out there, Nerve 10 is cranial nerve 10, which connects, runs from the brain stem down to the heart and the lungs and the colon and all these different places. And I thought it was such a fascinating concept for mental health, because I really think mental health is connected to everything. Mm-hmm. I really do. In my experience, it is. So Nerve 10 was something I had to get into my social work program. I needed to have a certain prerequisite. I guess because I studied finance and political science in undergrad, I didn't have all the prerequisites. Yeah. So I had to take like anatomy and one other class, like I think a social sciences class. And I remember reading about Nerve 10 and things like, wow, that's pretty cool. If I ever do a blog, I'm going to name it Nerve 10.
That's awesome. I love it.
And so Nerve 10 came around, I think like 2016 when I first started grad school, and when I went to Virginia for grad school at VCU, I started Nerve 10 because I felt like I had a lot to share. I felt like I had been through some tough stuff, and mm-hmm. I had also been a support group facilitator and a family to family teacher for NAMI. And I actually felt like I had a knack for empowering people, not just like paternalistically helping them. You know, I don't love the word help.
Yeah.
I felt like I could actually walk alongside them and really support people to get out of their struggles.
Yeah.
So I wanted to share some things, mainly because I couldn't find the kind of content online that I wanted to read that felt relatable to me. I think you mentioned the word jargon earlier. I even gave a presentation in grad school to professors and students that you search mental health. And this was back in 2016. I would put in the words mental health in Google, and suicide would come up, and like danger and warning, all this stuff.
Right.
And I even showed them the slide. You search physical health, though, you literally get little kids in gym class running around giggling. You put mental health in, and it's all about danger and you're going to die.
Right.
And I just thought that was wrong because I felt there was a way to talk about mental health that actually like was more encouraging and accessible and educating people. So it started with Nerve 10. The mental health update didn't come until 2 years ago, which it was just a different iteration of it. I wanted to do a newsletter because I really like email newsletters, and I turned it into that. But it started way, way back with my experiences and my desire to share.
That's cool. One of the other things, and thank you for putting it together. And I like what you say about the wording. So we do a search. So imagine all the people that did the same searches, right, on mental health.
Absolutely.
And then saw the images that were, you know, terrifying, horrific, and scary.
Yeah. Call 911. If you're feeling suicidal, call 911 right now. It's like, oh, okay. Not exactly.
Right. And it trigger the fear, right? Get that reaction of the fear, the fight, flight, freeze. One of the things that I find, I don't say fascinating. I look at patterns. I can see pattern connections.
I love patterns.
And the way things fit together. Mm-hmm. And so one of the patterns that I see right now is, and it's a pattern of the use of language. And before it was, using words like mindfulness, right? There was this mindfulness movement, and we've shifted, we meaning society, has shifted from mindfulness to now the word trauma and casually using the word trigger, which I don't find that beneficial. It's like if somebody was to say, you know, maybe something is, they're being persistent on organizing something, And they would use the phrase, oh, you know, I'm being OCD. Things like that really bother me.
I just heard that the other day. It's people.
That really bothers me.
It bothers me too. And I realize it comes from like a lack of knowledge. I even had students who you think like social work students are so enlightened and they're just going to be the greatest people ever. I was really disappointed about my social work education and honestly about formal education in general. I think I told you earlier, I don't always love it. I had students who I remember we were sharing in class and I'm an open book. So I just kind of talk about my experiences. I realize now that a lot of the students were like coming right out of undergrad. They're a bit younger. Maybe they weren't so open. And I was talking about how I have OCD and it's just mainly intrusive thoughts. I literally got students in my class saying, oh, you don't look like the kind of person, like, are you sure you have OCD? Like, you don't seem like the kind of, and I was like, well, I've been diagnosed, been in the hospital, and I take medicine for it, and I'm pretty sure I have this kind of OCD. Like, it's not maybe what you think of it, right. But I just remember having these conversations with like the future social workers of the world who just were not that open-minded. It was very bizarre.
I had a conversation. We're vetting right now applications for a leadership position with PTSD and beyond, and during a conversation with an executive. They said, isn't PTSD a military thing? It's like, that's no, let's have a conversation about that though. So during that vetting process, I felt like, you know, I was educator, advocate, and then also to help, I don't want to say dissipate, but help to clear the air on myths, misconceptions, stigma, and to bring the, well, you know, actually this is what it is. And it can happen in these different ways. Where do you see things going right now with mental health for future generations, as well as what people are facing right now, whether we're talking about pandemic or we're talking about some of the things that have been happening with, you know, Wisconsin, for example, different groups? I mean, where do you think we're headed right now? Where do you think we're headed, and what do you think some of the hopeful pieces are? Because I'm finding right now that things aren't looking very, you know, there's too much of the one-sided. And I don't know, and to circle back from my thought earlier was, I think that there's this repetitive shock factor, right, to activate that fight response. And how much more of that is really sustainable? I mean, marketing's been using that for years. Organizations been using it for, you know, years to get a reaction for buyers, right? IO psychology, you know, used in marketing with business.
Yep.
And anything from even like music videos. I was talking to a friend the other day about music videos back in the 80s of things that were considered to be just, you know, outrageous. And then, you know, look where we're at today. I mean, how much more does it need to get before, you know, things actually start getting better?
This is a loaded question. I'm trying to decide where I want to start with this because you know, I think about this a lot and write about this.
We got time, Jordan.
So I don't want to depress all your listeners, but I don't think I'm a pessimist. I think I'm a realist, but it often comes across as pessimist because I like to just take a real measured approach and figure out what's really going on. And I thought about this a lot. I am discouraged by a lot of what I see, and I won't follow the news. I won't read or watch mass media because a lot of people I respect said they don't do that and they're just fine. And then I tested that for myself and I realized, wow, I don't need to. And I'm a lot happier if I don't follow mass media because, like you said, it sensational does really well. And what is that quote? If it bleeds, it leads. Like, that is very true. Things that maybe statistically are not very likely will still get on the front page if it's shocking. If you like, if someone got shot or someone's not, like, that's important, clearly.
Isn't it addictive though too? Doesn't because it does release hormones that become like addictive. It's like, you got to go back.
Well, that's a big part of the media. And I study technology and media and I'm fascinated by it. And I'm interested in the intersection of like mental health and media. And people don't realize how addicting it can be. And I will give you an example of something that's really strange that's happening that I don't use it, but I've been on enough to know like kind of how it works. I don't use TikTok, but that is how a lot of the, you know, this up and coming generation gets their information. Let's face it, it's how they get their news. It's how they get their ideas. And something really weird that I've been trying to research more is doctors' offices are seeing more teenagers coming in for like tics they've developed, believe it or not.
I don't know if you've read this. Yes, I have read this.
Literally happening where, and this is where my brain goes, and it's kind of scary because I'm an overthinker, but these, so you know, TikTok is all about like kind of repeating these memes, like these video memes, people do the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, people are, kids are going into doctor's offices, repeating phrases, making movements. And so we talk about how like, social media and Facebook can be used by Russian actors and international actors to influence. Well, if this is happening at TikTok, what does that mean for like getting people to mimic behavior? If teens are going into offices because they can't control what they're doing, that my brain went, well, that would be kind of scary if like a foreign actor started like figuring out how to get people to act in a certain way.
Isn't it subliminal programming?
Stuff like that, which sounds like cuckoo, right? Like you don't want to talk about that, but like this is actually something that could happen with the kind of technology. And now we're talking about the metaverse and what does that mean? And
right.
Are you going to spend all your time in a metaverse? So these are the kinds of things that I think about, because you the medium is the message, right? So the way you use a medium like Twitter or Facebook changes how you communicate. So I think Twitter is great and I love Twitter, but I also see the horrible sides of it too, where people are just scanning, flitting through everything and not really understanding. They're reacting so strongly without having a conversation. Like you got to be really conscious about the medium you're on and how that influences how you act.
There's definitely a subliminal component to it, because you know the movie Wall-E? Have you ever seen that kids movie? I love kids movies because they bring up.
I know the movie. I'm a loser. I don't watch any TV. So like if people ever come bring up TV, I was like, oh, let me check out of the conversation for 10 minutes. I'll come back when the movie talk is done, because I never see any movies.
So I'm usually known as the fun mom. Okay. I'm the fun mom. Except there's a little exception, right? My disclaimer is when I watch movies, okay, with my kids, whether it's Star Trek or whatever we're watching, because I'll sit there and I'll be like, wait a minute. You know, like I was watching a program the other day and they had this baby. And I said to my son, that is a fake baby. That is not a real baby actor. That is a doll. And he said, how do you know? And I said, because when the dad was holding the baby's head, he released his hand off the head. And I said, newborn babies don't have a needle. So the doll is, and I'm like, that's a fake baby actor. Anyway,
we're so similar. I think we are so similar, because this is actually where I started to hate movies, I think, because I would watch something like National Treasure. What is that movie? Like Nicolas Cage. It was like, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. What just happened there? That doesn't link up with that. And like my friend would be like, shut up. Like, this is a good movie. I was like, no, that's stupid. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And so I think we're very similar.
I've done the same thing with Star Trek. I even took my kids out of school because there's a Star Trek convention in Kansas City, which is only about a 6-hour drive from us. Oh, and I'm like talking to each of the actor. Okay. So on this episode, when you were with Quark, that didn't work. So the writers, and my kids are like, oh my God, there's my mother. Anyway, circling back to my original thought about the movie Wall-E. So in one part of the movie, right, all the people are on this boat and they've got these visors on, right? And they're doing their VR thing, virtual reality, right? Mm-hmm. Where does that subliminal programming and that virtual reality, again, connecting to another movie, Harry Potter, where he's sitting in front of this mirror, right? That brings back his parents. We become addicted to that because of fill in the blank reason, right? The void, whatever. We're trying to escape something. My point with bringing this up is that how do we tell what's real from what's not real when we're being told that it's real? And then we're seeing effects such as tic development. We're seeing effects such as that dopamine. I got to go back and get it. I got to get it from places from places where we're looking for strategies to improve our mental health. So how do we do that?
Well, that's one of the reasons I started
million-dollar the mental question, health update. Right?
it's one of the reasons I started the mental health update, because I really felt like I had this kind of I wouldn't say unique. I mean, I'm sure other people could say it, but I have this, I do a lot of thinking, so, and I want to share some information that's helped me, because I get very nervous, and I've always been this way, and I'm very weird, and I'm glad I finally like myself now, and I appreciate what I've done in life, but I always been kind of like an individual thinker, which in high school and college is not really appreciated, to be honest. Like teachers don't like when you're the one asking questions over and over. They don't love it. I even found that in grad school. People found it annoying when I want to get my money's worth, but they want to leave class early. So like, stop asking questions, Jordan. And I'm there trying to learn stuff.
Right.
So I think it starts with kind of knowing yourself and asking questions all the time about your own experience and learning from your own experience. What I wanted to add is that if I see a lot of people, and for better or for worse, if I see a lot of people doing something like getting on TikTok, going to a Dave Matthews Band concert in high school, I want to do the complete opposite. Like, I did not want to do what everyone is doing, because I just felt like that was not fun or even dangerous. Like, I want to develop my own ideas. So I think that's actually been a real benefit in this day and age, that I'm the guy walking down the street reading a book. Like, people have their smartphone they're looking at, and that's acceptable. But I get stared if I'm reading a book walking down the street, because I like reading. But I also think that me reading hundreds of books over the last few years has given me an approach that's very different than people who are spending all of their hours on Netflix or on TikTok or wherever.
Right.
I really, really believe in doing your own thing and deciding for yourself. And it's only really by following my own path that I've developed like a unique viewpoint. And I'm able to share all this in a way that's different than what people might see on just the run of the mill social media or media, if you know what I mean.
Yep. So there's four key things, folks. And thank you again for staying with us and listening. And again, Jordan, thank you for being here too. So there's a few things here. One is know yourself, ask questions, understand yourself and develop your own ideas. Read, which I love to read. I bought myself a couple books for Christmas. They're going to go under the tree.
It's a superpower. I read more during the day than I spend. Another thing I do that's weird is I eat as a function, like a very functional eater. So I hate cooking. I want to eat very, if I could get an IV drip of food into my arm, I would. It's really weird, but I often read so much I'll forget to eat or something. And I just love learning. I'm very curious.
Yeah.
But I don't love like doing things like cooking. So it can drive my wife crazy. And luckily she likes cooking. She's a great chef and I'll clean up, but I just know what I like doing and like kind of what provides value for me. And I almost do it to an extreme.
I like that. Know what you like doing.
Yeah. Which is a skill. And there are meta schools that I wish people would talk about, like thinking about thinking, thinking about learning. How do you learn? How do you learn faster? These are just things that we're not discussing anymore. I really wish that they taught us that in school. I had to learn that on my own.
I took philosophy as a second area of study in undergrad. Nice. You know, what was funny too, is I bounced around from psychology to sociology, and then I wanted to take philosophy and somebody told me I wasn't smart enough to take it. And that really pissed me off.
Who are these?
So I was like, this was an attorney too. And so I took the first class from a professor, and I want to give a shout out to, I hope to God, maybe we can reconnect one day, but Professor Carlson Jones, I know he's retired from Eastern Michigan University. And I took his class and people were saying, oh my gosh, you know, he's really super tough. He never gives out A's. And I found him to be so mentally stimulating and challenging. And I would deliberately take his classes because he pushed people to think. And
I love that. Yeah.
I remember one time we were talking about, it was an epistemology class, right? How do you know what you know? How do you acquire knowledge? Right. And what is constitution of truth, right? So now I'm going to date myself here. Anyway, we were talking about like, you know, the blackboard solid, and he held up a piece of chalk and he said, this chalk is white. And I said, no, it's not. He said, yeah, it is. And I said, no, it's not. It's not white. So I said, and remember, I gave him two examples. I said, okay, this one probably people can relate to. Okay. You get like a thing of chocolate. Someone gives you a gift of chocolate. It's a chocolate bunny rabbit, right? And you're looking at it and you think it's chocolate bunny rabbit. And it's solid. because you're holding it and you feel it.
Right.
Yeah. When you bite into it, you find out not only is it hollow, but it's got this creamy, gooey stuff inside that you absolutely loathe. Or the white chalk, right? There was a TV commercial years ago that took a piece of chalk and it dipped it in this blue liquid to show penetration of fluoride in tooth enamel. And you break open that, it's blue on the outside, right? Shows like a blue piece of chalk. And you break it open. And in essence, that chalk was white with blue on the outside. So I said, if you break open that piece of chalk, maybe it's going to be blue on the inside. So you don't really know for a fact. Piece is white, right? And he was just looking at me like, who are you?
Yeah. People don't like, people don't love that. I remember, I had a very similar weird conversation with, and this was actually a good professor. It wasn't an adjunct that VCU grad school had so many of. It was a professor who was the statistics professor. And I remember she was talking about the bell curve or like the Gaussian curve, you know, and how it describes the world. And I said, but not exactly, it didn't exactly describe everything. Right. And she's like, no, this is a good representation of the world. And how does things follow a bell curve? I'm like, but I'm reading this book, The Black Swan, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. And she's like, oh, is that the one about the ballet dancer? And I said, no, not, that's not the one about the ballet dancer. It's this book about statistics and like kind of things we don't see in the world. And now The Black Swan is a little more famous. It was Jeff Bezos's favorite book. And I think that's how I learned about it. But it's talking about all the evidence we don't see. And just because like you could go your whole life thinking that a swan is white, until one day in another part of the world, you see a black swan. And so he was talking about these black swan events that like, just because they've never happened before, doesn't mean they can't happen. Right. Like the big example of the turkey's life. And it's perfect for Thanksgiving. The turkey's life is alive for hundreds of days. And it's like, oh, I have a great life. My owner feeds me this great food. And then one day, all of a sudden, if it followed that little trend, it would think it's going to continue to have a great life until the day before Thanksgiving, it gets killed by the loving owner because it just didn't have a complete view of reality. So you just never really know what's going on. And I think you're a kindred spirit with me because you ask these questions. But I mean, my class, that's this class, they thought I was the most annoying person in the world. It's like, why is he talking about this book? Why is he bringing up this thing? But to that professor's credit, we actually kept up a relationship. She said she started reading it. She found it fascinating. So I love that. I love just people who are willing to like entertain new ideas and learn about them.
I have another one, another meaning a child who is like, you know, does apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Yeah. And how many times I've had to go to school based on, they call it distraction. It's like, no, they're actually asking because they want to know more and learn. And you bring up a really great point about the evidence we don't see it, which is why I like outliers, because outliers tell us something else.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't always mean it's an anomaly. There's something about the outlier. There's value in the outlier. There's exploration and understanding, a deeper level of understanding with outliers, something, another place to explore. Have you read any Malcolm Gladwell by any chance?
I did. I read all of those a long time ago, so I probably remember the general ideas, but it's been a long time since I've read his books.
Yeah, he's a guest. Hey, anybody out there that's listening that knows Malcolm Gladwell, shoot him an email and say, hey, you should be on PTSD and Beyond.
Oh, I thought you were about to say he was a guest.
No, I'd love to have him as a guest. Oh my gosh.
You're really going down with me. You're not, man, I'm not that level.
You know, I think that'd be fascinating. So one of the things, why we have these kind of conversations, Jordan, is because there's always that clinical perspective available, right? Where we need to, I think, to bring things home is the everyday life. And these are conversations
Absolutely.
That need
That's
to happen.
That's why I write.
Absolutely. Exactly. So you provide a newsletter of this type of content. We provide a podcast. Now we've got you on the podcast to provide this type of conversation to happen because this is where we live. We don't live in a bubble. Yes. We don't live in a clinical, like controlled environment.
Very well said.
We live out here. And these are types of conversations and information, as well as just connection with listeners of ways to make things better, 5 tips that you can try, something to think deeper about, a question that maybe there's a listener right now who's got a question that they've always wanted to ask, but just never felt like they fit within, say, like the outliers, right? I mean, like the movie The Breakfast Club. great mm-hmm. movie of mm-hmm. about a bunch of misfits.
I've actually seen it. Yeah.
Who found their place, you know? I mean, it's like when people come to PTSD and beyond, especially like the Twitter chat on Mondays, it's like, I can show up at any time. When I listen to your podcast, I feel like, you know what, someone relates to me. So yep. if someone's out there that has a question that you've always wanted to ask, and you're kind of like, where do I go? Reach out to Jordan, reach out to myself. We'll have Jordan's information in the bio summary, ways that you can follow him to sign up to those newsletter mm-hmm. and also places to connect on social media. Jordan, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? And by the way, listener, thank you so much for still being here with us today.
Wow. I think you did a really good job there. And it's why I really appreciate our conversation, because I do love your approach. I think you said it so well that you could be talking about clinical terms all you want, but if you don't reach people like where they are, which right. is like the ethos of the social worker, like meet people where they are, then what's the point? You're not going to make any change. So I have always tried to make my content as accessible as possible. And it just makes my month, really, if someone responds to a newsletter and says, you don't feel like you're talking down to me. I finally understand this concept. Like, thank you for writing this in a way that I actually understand. And I'm not like diminished or like made fun of or something, because we all have mental health. Like, it's just such a, like, to me, that's the most obvious thing in the world now. But to a lot of people, they still think it's a scary thing that we are not supposed to be talking about. And yeah. especially in certain communities, like maybe communities of color or whatever, there are still groups, marginalized groups, that you're not allowed to talk about this. And I've had similar conversations with like Black men and women, lesbian Black women. Like, it's just like these different groups that don't talk about this thing. So I guess the only thing I would say, because you did that, is there anything else I want to add? Is that if you haven't heard of the Mental Health Update, definitely check it out. It's the Mental Health Update is a website and a newsletter. And I'm also helping, now that I work for myself, I'm helping brands I believe in. I'm helping projects. Like, well, a cool thing that I'm working on that I'll just plug here is that we're improving the design of it, but the idea is really, really good. It's called Treatment Scout. And what we're doing is like basically categorizing and ranking all like inpatient mental health facilities, anything from like intensive patient, outpatient,
wow.
To ketamine, to
yeah.
TMS, transcranial magnetic yep. stimulation,
yep.
which if you've ever tried to search for that for a loved one, it's really hard to find. And I know I do this all the time. So I'm so glad I got connected with, he's a mentor of mine that I'm working with on this, that it's really hard to, if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not a social worker, to know what's a good facility, what's not, if yep. are they open? Do they accept insurance? Do right. they even have a good website? So right. this treatmentscout.com is basically, it's going to turn into a review site where people can have real reviews. We currently pull reviews from Google, and it's just easier to find stuff in your state. Wow. And so that's something I'm really excited about. And it's kind of follows my mission of making things more accessible, because it's not accessible right now. And that's one of the most important decisions you can make. Like, I know yep. it from getting my mom into a hospital, and for me going into a hospital too, for depression, that it's not easy, and yep. it should be easier to find the information.
That's definitely a need. I can say that from my own personal experience.
I'd love yep. to get your take on it too, because I've just started helping them out, and I really believe in what they're trying to do.
That's super cool. Yep, absolutely. People need to have a place where they can go to see the evaluations, as well as maybe yes. you know, a rating
like
criteria.
Honest, transparent, not like a marketing speak from a hospital about right. how good they are. Like, actually what happened to people there. Right. That's what we're trying to do with Treatment Scout.
Yep, totally. Treatment Scout. Guys, you can go find Jordan Brown's information at thementalhealthupdate.com. Again, we'll have all of the active links in the summary bio. If you do connect with Jordan, can you please let him know and say, hey, man, I found you at PTSD and Beyond. That was an awesome podcast, by the way. Remember to subscribe. And thank you so much. We recently reached our over 25,000 downloads, which is super nice. Cool. And we haven't
Congrats.
Done. Thank you. I know our team needs to get together and see the new count. But we're still at, you know, 80 plus, but it might be 90 plus at this point. We okay. need to get back to the, you know, counting of the countries. So again, thank you so much wow. for your support. And Jordan, again, it was a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me here. I really enjoyed this. And I think we're two peas in a pod here. We got to
think
keep,
so.
got to keep doing the good work.
We do, for sure. Guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. Remember to check us out. Again, we drop every Friday, and we'll see each other again next time. So make it a good one, eh?